Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back presenting to this conference. Today, I'm going to talk to you about the main risks that banks face and how those risks have evolved and the response to them has adapted. Given the Reserve Bank's mandate for overall financial stability, I also want to talk about when those bank risks can become systemic financial risks. It's important to note that risk is not a dirty word for banks. Banks' core business is managing risks. When they do that well by offsetting, controlling, and appropriately pricing risk, they can increase economic activity and improve people's standard of living. In doing this, banks remove risk from the balance sheet of businesses and households. They facilitate businesses investing and hedging, and they enable households to smooth consumption, notably by purchasing housing. But when banks don't manage risks well, the consequences can be devastating, both for the bank and for society. There are four main risks that are central to being a bank: credit risk, market risk, liquidity risk, and operational risk. Banks' core business is lending money to customers, and so they will always face credit risk with the uncertainty about whether customers will be able to repay those debts. They also, of course, face market risk with the potential for losses as a result of unexpected movements in the value of financial assets, such as commodities, exchange rates, or interest rates. Banks also face liquidity risk from the mismatch between their long-dated liquid assets, which are mostly loans, and their short-term liquid liabilities, in particular deposits and money market funding. The last of the four core bank risks is operational risk, which is the risk of loss from inadequate or failed internal processes or systems, and of course, human error. There are many other risks that are attributed to banks, but many of those are just another name for or part of the four core risks I've just mentioned. These four core banking risks are the same risks that banks have faced for hundreds of years, but the nature of those risks continues to evolve. These risks have been prominent in the past 15 years, given two major shocks, the global financial crisis and, of course, now the COVID pandemic. Credit risk is the main risk we think of when it comes to banks, and it continues to be the most prominent risk. Certainly, since the GFC, it is the risk that the major Australian banks communicate most about, given the number of references to credit risk in their annual report, as shown in this graph. The significance of credit risk was highlighted with the onset of the COVID pandemic. Forecasts of very large contractions in economic activity and rising unemployment led banks to anticipate large credit losses and so substantially increase their provisioning. As it turns out, losses have been and are expected to continue to be much smaller because of the better than expected economic conditions and direct fiscal payments to affected households and businesses. With smaller expected credit losses, banks have even started to reduce their stock of provisions. Market risk gets almost as much attention in banks' annual reports as credit risk, as shown in the graph. But Australian banks don't have large investments in marketable securities. Most of their assets are loans, and in particular, housing loans. Banks hedge most of the interest rate risk from the maturity mismatch on their assets and liabilities, but they still face market risk on any leftover mismatches in how quickly their assets and liabilities can be repriced. Internationally, the GFC increased the focus on the valuation of financial securities, particularly those with little price transparency. This also increased the attention on the market risk for banks that hold significant financial assets. Liquidity risk has always been important for banks. Historically, the focus for banks and policymakers has been on the potential for a deposit run. But the GFC demonstrated that there can be just as large a risk of a run on wholesale funding. And a wholesale run can be very fast and damaging to a bank's balance sheet. The GFC was a crisis that started in the financial system. Financial conditions before the crisis were very expansionary, but tightened rapidly with the onset of the crisis, even in Australia, as we see here in this graph. While the early stages of the GFC were a liquidity crisis, prompt provision of additional liquidity by central banks greatly reduced that aspect of the crisis. The COVID pandemic was very different because it was an exogenous shock to the financial system. But the central banks still quickly saw the potential for tighter liquidity conditions and, to an even greater extent than the GFC, ramped up the provision of liquidity to forestall a significant liquidity shock. As a result, financial conditions quickly returned to being expansionary, as we see at the end of the graph. One consequence of these two events is that globally, banks have seen that central banks will increase the provision of liquidity in response to large systemic liquidity shocks. And so they expect there is less need for them to self-insure against these extreme shocks. This makes sense for society, as liquidity can actually be thought of as being a public good. But the banks still do need to insure against moderate systemic and idiosyncratic liquidity shocks. The reforms that followed the GFC mean that banks are much better placed to deal with liquidity shocks, perhaps because of their confidence in their own liquidity and their potential for central bank liquidity. Australian banks give less prominence to liquidity risk in their annual reports. Operational risks have evolved and in general intensified over time, particularly for banks that have become larger and more complex. There is also some evidence that operational risk correlates with macroeconomic conditions, and so potentially with the other core banking risks. Internationally, there was a spike in operational losses following the GFC related to improper operating practices in the boom prior to the GFC. The same sort of issues had some prominence in Australia, were given the recent Royal Commission. Two banking risks that are getting increasing attention are those stemming from climate change and cyber attacks. In fact, these are not distinct risks. Both are representation of the four core banking risks I've just described. Climate change is a part of a broader category of ESG risks that are getting increasing attention. Two separate physical risks are typically identified as resulting from climate change. There's physical risk, which is the potential for the reduction in a bank's income or value of its assets, in particular the collateral used for loans, that could result from the physical effects of climate change. For example, this could be severe storms, bushfires, or more extreme temperatures and rainfall, which might reduce crop yields or tourism revenues. Transition risk is the potential for losses because of changes in policy, technology, and the behaviour, all of which can occur because we're moving to a less emissions-intensive economy. Physical and transition risks are sometimes referred to as horizontal risks because they cross all four core banking risks. For example, for climate change, there is credit risk because climate change can result in falls in borrowers' incomes and declines in the value of their assets, which secure loans. This could come either because of physical risk, for example, droughts and storms result in smaller crops, or transition risks. For example, a coal miner could experience a sharp fall in the value of their mine if demand for coal reduces with policy changes. Credit risk is the most significant part of climate risk. There is also market risk because of the risks from climate change could result in falls or unexpected volatility in the value of financial assets. There can be liquidity risk, for example, because a bank may not be able to roll over its short-term wholesale funding if investors are concerned about its climate exposure. Banks can also face operational risk from extreme weather. For example, Hurricane Sandy forced banks in New York to close offices. Just as in other countries, banks in Australia are now paying substantial attention to climate change. Climate change risks now get even more attention in banks' annual reports than liquidity risk. In contrast, they weren't even mentioned only a few years ago. While 5 or 10 years ago, climate risk was not even in the job description of a major bank CRO, Now, the CRO is intimately involved in a bank's response to climate change, reflecting the risks that climate change poses to banks. But quantifying and pricing the impact of climate change on their risks is challenging for banks. Most banks do not yet have sufficiently detailed data to estimate their exposure, such as the disaggregated data they need on the emissions of their counterparties, or the detailed location information for assets used as collateral. They also faced uncertainty about the impact of climate change mitigation policies and the physical effects of climate change. The Reserve Bank has recently published some initial work quantifying the impact of climate change on Australian banks through physical and transition risks. That work finds that in regions most exposed to extreme weather, a small share of housing could experience price falls, which increases the chance of lenders having credit losses. But for the scenario used and based on the available information on banks' assets, the overall losses for the financial system appear to be manageable at this stage. Banks are also exposed to transition risks from their lending to emissions-intensive industries, which again exposes them to credit risk. Although overall, the Australian banks' portfolios appear to be less emissions-intensive than the economy as a whole. Another important step in Australia for developing our own understanding of climate risks is the climate vulnerability assessment being undertaken by APRA on behalf of the Council of Financial Regulators. The CVA is currently being run with the five largest banks, and the results should be published next year. As part of the CFR, the Reserve Bank is assisting in the CVA, including with the macroeconomic assessment. The other so-called emerging risk getting increasing attention is cyber risk. Cyber risk is a type of operational risk, and it's actually existed for quite some time. It's the risk that a financial loss, operational disturbance, or damage resulting from disruption, a failure, or misuse of an IT system. Realized cyber risk can take many forms. There could be theft of funds or valuable commercial or personal information. There could be disruption of services, corruption of data, and that could be for ransom. It's difficult to assess the extent of cyber risks generally in the economy, as firms don't tend to publicly disclose attacks, and there isn't uniform or comprehensive reporting of cyber attacks. But everything points to increasing cyber attacks. The Australian Cyber Security Centre received 13% more cybercrime reports last year than in the previous financial year, and a larger share of those were classified as being severe. Various sources also suggest that the financial sector is one of the most targeted sectors. The Australian banks are also increasingly discussing the cyber risks they face, as the graph shows. While the number of mentions of cyber risk in banks' annual reports is still fewer than the four core banking risks, it has much greater prominence today than only a few years ago. The pandemic has increased this risk further, with more employees working from home and more digital banking, both of which increase possible entry points for attackers. Cyber risk in many ways is different to the other bank risks that banks face. There's an adversary, someone who is trying to profit at the bank's expense. In that sense, it is closest to theft, another operational risk. But while bank robbers have traditionally been restricted to being able to steal the amount of cash in a bank branch or an armored car, cybercrimes can involve much larger losses for banks. Another aspect of cybercrime that is truly different to other risks banks face is that the adversary may actually not be seeking a financial profit, but may want to just disrupt the operation of the bank or indeed the broader financial system. And those sort of motives make it even harder to anticipate and defend against cyber attacks. The large Australian banks have substantial resources to deploy in their cyber defences, and so they're generally regarded as being at least as well protected as other large firms in Australia. It can be difficult for smaller banks to maintain equivalent cyber defences because of their smaller resources. Relative to some other expenses banks face, cyber defences have fairly large fixed costs compared to the variable costs that scale with the size of the bank. Like all banks, like all firms, I should say, banks have to pay attention not only to their own cyber defences, but those of any third-party suppliers they use. APRA directly supervises around 680 financial entities, but the financial system more broadly consists of around 17,000 interconnected entities, including those third-party service providers, and they are all possible avenues for cyber risk. Entities regulated by APRA are required to apply appropriate cybersecurity controls, develop active governance around cybersecurity, and report material cyber incidents to APRA. Regulated entities are also responsible for ensuring the compliance by their third-party suppliers. The CFR is piloting a framework for adversarial testing of financial markets participants' cyber defences and also their resilience. This exercise is mimicking the tactics, the techniques, and the procedures that are used in real-world cyber attacks. In doing so, it'll test how well banks and financial market infrastructure more broadly can detect, respond, and recover when faced with an unknown cyber attack. Given the large number of cyber attacks on Australian banks, it's probably not a matter of if, but when there is a major cyber breach. And that's a point that APRA has made repeatedly. So it's important that bank cyber defences are resilient, but it's even more important of their broader resilience, how they would recover from an attack. This detection and response is an important part of the cyber testing being undertaken by the CFR agencies. I'd now like to turn to how those core banking risks can result in systemic risks for the broad financial system. A stable financial system facilitates the flow of funds between savers and investors, and in doing so, supports economic growth. If that smooth functioning of the overall financial system is disrupted, it can cause some substantial harm to economic activity and to our daily lives. We only have to think back to the GFC to be reminded of the significant cost globally to employment, incomes, and welfare from a financial crisis. The Reserve Bank has a mandate for overall financial stability, and so we very carefully monitor these systemic risks. There are a number of factors that increase the likelihood that bank risk becomes systemic risk. These include whether the affected bank is large, if the risk of the nature of that risk means that it's correlated across banks and so would be realized simultaneously in multiple banks, if there's a high degree of interconnection or it affects a critical node of the financial system, such as a central counterparty, if the realization of that risk is likely to be persistent and so it would have a long-lasting effect, or if it's realized when uncertainty or risk aversion is particularly high, say, for example, in a global pandemic. These factors have elements of credit, market, liquidity, and even operational risk. For example, Australian banks have similar portfolios. In particular, they have substantial housing lending. So they have similar credit and market risk. A significant increase in credit risk would affect a large share of banking assets and so could become systemic. The large Australian banks have similar funding structures, including which international capital markets they borrow in. So significant realizations of liquidity risk would have the potential to become systemic, although, as I noted, the Reserve Bank has substantial ability to address significant systemic liquidity crises. Even operational risk can become systemic if it were to be realized in, say, a central counterparty or spilled over from one bank to others because the affected bank could not make its payment obligations. And also the so-called emerging risks, climate risk and cyber risk, are on our radar as being systemic risks. Just as banks have been paying increasing attention to those risks, so have we at the Reserve Bank. And we too have been communicating more about them, both cyber risk and climate risk, as shown in this graph, from the count of the number of mentions in our financial stability review. The financial risks from climate change are clearly systemic, as climate change will affect the portfolios of all banks. Cyber risk need not be systemic. It could affect only one bank. But if that bank is large and interconnected, or the cyber attack affects a critical node in the financial system, it could very well become systemic. So summing up, banks today face the same four core risks that they have faced for decades or even hundreds of years: credit, market, liquidity, and operational risk. But those risks have evolved, as highlighted by our growing prominence of risks that are across these four core risks: climate change and cyber risk. How risks are managed has also changed substantially. For example, the Basel III reforms after the GFC resulted in banks holding more capital and liquid assets, while the latest capital reforms from APRA make bank risk weights more sensitive to the risks of different loans. The upcoming capital reforms will better allocate capital to risk by adjusting risk rates, improve flexibility by increasing the capital in buffers, boost loss-absorbing capacity, and improve the quality and transparency of reporting on regulatory requirements. It's crucial that banks continue to adapt their risk management for these evolving risks, as those bank risks can easily morph into systemic risks that have the potential for dire consequences for the economy and for people's livelihoods. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present today, and I'm now very happy to take your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Excellent talk. So we do have a few questions here coming through the chat. And to everyone that is connected, please do take advantage of the live Q&A option. That's where you can be sending your questions through. So we're going to start off, though, with something that obviously if the RBA is aware, there has been some criticism of banks restricting lending to those that are carbon intensive firms, such as miners. But how much of this is valid and how much of this is kind of sensationalized around that topic?
This is a difficult area for banks. They need to be very forward-looking in their decisions on lending. So they need to consider that both changing policy and changing attitudes. So, for example, asset prices can change very quickly in response to not only current policy changes, but expected policy changes or expected behaviour. So, for example, a bank might think about writing a three-year loan to a coal miner. And they might anticipate that there are not going to be any significant changes in policy over the next 3 years. But if they did expect that there was going to be a change in policy in, say, 5 years or 10 years' time, that in itself could actually mean that the value of the assets that they're lending against, the value of the coal mine, could fall significantly. And so it could be that when that initial three-year loan comes up, that the coal miner struggles to be able to refinance that loan. And so the bank who made the initial loan would be still left holding a loan that can't be repaid and so would face credit risk. So it can be quite challenging for banks because they need to be anticipating what's going to be happening down the track and how that's going to affect the likelihood that the borrower will be able to repay. So, you know, the credit risk, the market risk that they're facing. And they obviously also need to think about how this affects their reputation, which can flow through to their ability for funding. So funding risk, liquidity risk, and so forth. So it is really a challenging area. And you know, we can see why banks are taking this very seriously.
Excellent. Yes, thank you. I think that is an issue that, one, we kind of miscalculate when you're trying to actually manage maturity and mismanagement of maturity when it comes to some of these issues as well. So another question is kind of the elephant in the room, wherever you are in Sydney or, you know, even Australia as whole, about the housing market and kind of the affordability of the housing market. So specifically here, The housing market has been in the media, obviously, with APRA's macroprudential measure increasing the serviceability around the ability for borrowers to actually be able to take out loans, depending on if interest rates were to rise. So in terms of the roles, do we see that there are macroprudential policies have in addressing bank and systemic risk? Is it able to, you know, effectively trickle down? Or is this something to say that we're, you know, we're kind of in this world where we're always have borrowers on one hand and they're not always the stakeholders within the banks themselves?
Yeah, as I noted, the Australian banks have very similar portfolios, and that includes a very large share of their assets being housing loans. So housing lending is very important for understanding systemic risk. And macroprudential policy has gained a lot of prominence, most notably really globally following the GFC, where we've had very low interest rates in a number of countries. And so macroprudential policies have typically in most countries been employed to address housing risks. And, you know, in an environment of low interest rates where housing risks have been building. So we've seen them used in quite a number of countries for that reason. In Australia, similarly, we have low interest rates, and given the high level of housing debt for the household sector, both relative to history and other countries, it's clearly a risk both for the financial system and for the economy more broadly. When we do stress testing of the banks, either the bottom-up stress testing that APRA does, or APRA and ourselves also do top-down stress testing, those results indicate that the Australian banks are very resilient to any shocks to housing. And that comes because they have, for most loans outstanding, they actually have a relatively low dynamic LVR, meaning that you could experience a relatively large fall in prices and the banks would not necessarily lose any money. But because of that large stock of debt, it can clearly be a risk to the economy more broadly and so to the macro financial system. So macroprudential policy is really important in addressing that potential for systemic risk. The measure that APRA have implemented, a change in the serviceability assessment rate, is a really good way of getting at what is the potential risk in the system. It means that each borrower who ends up taking a loan is more resilient. They've got a bigger gap between their income and their housing and non-housing expenses. And so that gap can compensate for shocks to their income or expenses and makes it more likely that both they can make their repayments on their loans, but also that they're not going to curtail their consumption. And so you wouldn't have the big macroeconomic effect. So thanks.
I think that is the major thing, is the message that you're trying to make sure that everyone, every consumer, every banker, everyone understands, is that if you see a fall in consumption, regardless if those borrowers are able to make their mortgage payments, you're going to see that has massive repercussions across the economy. So is there a role for financial literacy? That it's hard when we are so apt to follow the movements of the cash rate and et cetera, but we don't know what it means for interest rates to go up or down if your borrowers are savers, you know. So how is that, where does that fall? I mean, is it on us as academics? Is it on the popular press? Or is there a role that you could see even within, you know, the ability to educate a little bit with this process currently now, and people are very, very keen to be, you know, understanding what happens now, right? The new world.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point. And that, you know, many people who are taking out a home loan now, you know, their working life up until recently had never seen a recession. You know, they'd had, you know, 30 years without a recession. Over their entire living experience, interest rates have been low. You know, they've never experienced the high interest rates of the 1990s, et cetera. And so, and they've always seen growing housing prices. So, you know, a lot of people can then think that, well, housing's a sure bet. I should just borrow as much as I can and gear up. And so I think it is really important that, you know, both the media, organizations like the Reserve Bank, academics, schools even, manage to sort of educate people and communicate, you know, what the risks are, that there is the potential for, you know, people to lose their income, for interest rates to increase. So if individuals are making prudent borrowing decisions, then that's really going to help to make the financial system more resilient also. So, you know, a lot of our work and communication is trying to ensure that the banks are making good decisions. And there's, you know, a lot of questions about, you know, who's responsible, whether it's the individual or the bank in making those decisions. The bank is obviously much better informed, but we want individuals to be able to make, you know, good decisions for themselves. And so I think that does involve ensuring that individuals are well informed and, you know, understand the risks that they're taking.
No, I think that's a good thing. The more we do on those lines, you're right, the better off they are. So I think we have one last question. It is a bit of a tricky one, but if in the case that global banks have learnt from that central banks will step in to resolve liquidity crisis, et cetera, doesn't that increase moral hazard?
Yeah, so there's a very important distinction there between something that's an extreme, broad, systemic liquidity crisis and something that's a liquidity crisis that affects a bank or an individual bank, so it's idiosyncratic. So, you know, we can think about liquidity as being a public good. And so, you know, in that situation, the central bank has effectively a mandate for ensuring that the broad financial system is sufficiently liquid. But an individual institution, if it faces a liquidity crisis, from, you know, a name crisis because it has, say, bad outcomes on its credit, it still needs to insure against that liquidity shock. And so, you know, the reforms that we've had post GFC, with the introduction of the liquidity coverage ratio, the net stable funding ratio, ensure that banks have a large amount of liquidity. I think what we're yet to see internationally is how usable that liquidity is. And so it could well be that banks have all of this liquidity, but as soon as they try to use that, investors could become very nervous. So there is a challenge there in how the new framework really works. Because, you know, what we've seen, even in the pandemic, has not been, in the end, a very significant liquidity shock for the banks, because of the amount of liquidity that central banks have provided. So I think it's still something that we have to watch carefully and learn a lot more about.